Hi everyone, so glad that y'all can make it out. Just wanted to give a little intro to what How I Know is about. It's about always being prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks you to give the reason for the hope that you have, 1 Peter. So the Bible kind of coaxes us into making sure we have a reason why we believe, not just because, oh, our mom and dad were Christians and it's just what we do, but we need to know why we believe. And this is how I know. Okay. Well, how I know was the outline of what's going to happen. And the first thing that's going to happen is I'm going to talk about my testimony and how I know started and the journey that I took to start this. And then it's going to go into my wife's discussion on creation and believing the Bible just as it says it is, the first first verse to the 38th verse, just exactly how it says, 6-day creation. So I joined the Army in 2003 after 9/11. I was pretty upset with what happened to our country after the Twin Towers were hit. I was just very upset, and I wanted to go to Iraq and kick down some doors and just pay people back for what they did to us. Then I didn't deploy until 2005 because I was with the reserve unit. My reserve unit was already in country in Iraq. So I had to wait, and I just went active duty in 2005. And this was our first base. This is Camp Victory in Iraq. And this is some of the command areas. And this is right where I used to ride my bike sometimes, just on my downtime. And they would play golf right into the lake. And there was some huge fish in there. Like, I don't know what kind of fish they were. They're just like, just very weird fish, and someone said that they like meat. I don't know. This was Saddam Hussein's, one of his palaces. So, this was on the bottom, right here. These were the trailers that we stayed in. So, my first year in Iraq, my first deployment was pretty cushy as far as cushy goes. Being deployed, we had electricity, air condition, a nice DFAC. My first deployment was just the greatest deployment that I could ever hope for. I had a lot of sergeants say that that this is as good as it gets because they'd been to Iraq in 2003 when it first happened. They said this is really nice, and I didn't believe them. I was very optimistic, and we had a great command. Great missions, great hours when we were working. Great people. I felt like when I was in Iraq, I was there when they first started voting. So I was like, yeah, we're spreading democracy, and this is great. And I'm here to help free people. That's what I first thought. I came back. Some people go. I turned 21 in Iraq. Some people go to college, you know, when they're younger. Some people go to war, and I went to war, and it was just a really good experience, and I grew a lot from it. Had a lot of close calls, but you know, made it out. This was after I came back, got a lot of new ribbons and stuff, and I was back for about a year and a half, and then I went to Afghanistan. And Afghanistan was completely opposite of Iraq. We slept in tents, no air condition. We had daily dust storms or sometimes hourly dust storms, depending on what. We had a terrible command, terrible missions, terrible hours. It was just the exact opposite of Iraq. Terrible SOP, standard operating procedures, when we encountered the enemy and different things. So it was just not a very good experience. And 4 months into my deployment, this was when I first was heading into Afghanistan. I was still optimistic here. I know I don't look like it, but but I was. And just want to let to note that the weapon I had is a 203. If you go back, okay. Well, okay. Well, that's a 203. And so, 4 months into my deployment, we roll over a 300-pound IED, and I got trapped underneath, right about here. Usually, I have a laser, but to show, but there, I'll. So it was about right here. I was trapped under there, and the hatch came down on my arm, and the arm I'm missing now. And the vehicle caught on fire, and so I was just trapped under there. And I remember just being in a daze. I remember feeling like it was a dream, and I thought, okay. You need to get out of here. Then I looked and I saw my arm was pinned down, and I just saw and smelled the flames and smelled the smoke, and they just crept over me, and over me. As the flames were over me, I was like, "All right, Jesus, I'm coming to meet you," and I knew what type of weapon I had. I had a 203, like I was saying earlier. And it is a plastic. It is a plastic round. It's that thing that's being inserted into it. They told me when I got these rounds, I asked, "What happens if they shoot me right on these rounds?" And they said, "Well, make sure you stay far enough away from everyone else." So I was like, I was just thought, well, it might not happen, so I gotta do this for my squad. And so I kept it. I didn't have a choice anymore. Yeah. They told me, "All right, Lopez, you're gonna do Mark 19 training." And I was like, oh man, I knew what that meant. That Mark 19 is, you got these types of rounds like a machine gun. So once I qualified on that, I knew they were gonna hand me the 203. So they handed me that. But as I was underneath the flames, I knew that I was a goner, because these things are made out of plastic, and I'm being burned alive right now, and they could go off any moment, but they didn't. And so they pulled me out. Could you go back to the wreckage? So one guy, he's a diesel mechanic, big guy. He just didn't care about the flames, didn't care about his safety, and he knew I was a 2-3 gunner. He just pulled me out, and they laid me on the ground, and they started to work on me. My combat medic, she was in the vehicle with me. She was right in front of me. Our knees were touching, because we're inside the MRAP. It's pretty tight in there. Plus, we had a lot of gear. And she's like, "I can't do it. I can't do it." And I said, "Koontz, you got to do this. You got to help me. You got to help my battle buddies." And what's the first step of evaluating a casualty? It's breathing, right? I'm breathing. I'm talking to you. What's the next step? Bleeding. Okay, stop the bleeding. So she got a handle on it, and she had broken two ankles too, and because the blast hit the bottom of the vehicle, and so she was working on me, and I was just lying in the ground in Afghanistan, burned, didn't have any clothes on because they got to see where the damage was, and I was I just wanted to shoot someone. I just wanted to. I was very upset, but I was like, someone needs to pay for this. But they just held me down and worked on me, and I waited for the bird to come, and it usually takes 45 minutes anywhere in Afghanistan. They'd say like a Domino's commercial, like anywhere in 25 minutes, and they said anywhere in 45 minutes you are in Afghanistan. So that was the longest 45 minutes of my life. And so they strapped me down, and this whole time I didn't have any morphine. My combat medic, she said that they didn't give her any because she had ran out of it. She had used it on my battle buddies from another company because we only had two medics in our whole company, and they would alternate them between when they were on mission and whatnot. So they got hit pretty hard the night before, the couple days before, so she didn't have any morphine. So I had the whole 45 minutes, I felt everything. They put me on the bird, and they tell me that I had lost too much blood after we got in the air, and I couldn't have any morphine. And I said that you're going to give me some morphine, or I will jump out of this helicopter. I will find a way. And they talked it over between the chief warrant officer and the medic on the helicopter, and they decided it's your funeral. And I said, I don't care. I want the morphine. I've been through enough pain already. I just want to be relieved of this pain. And if I die, I die. So I was already praying pretty good that, you know, I felt like I'd go to heaven. So there's no atheist in a foxhole, that's for sure. And I was in a foxhole at this moment. And they put me on the bird, and I was flying to a cash hospital, casualty, I don't know. I don't know the acronyms for it. Do you know, Scott? Do you know the acronyms for the Cash Hospital? Okay. Yeah, it's a field hospital. And so they brought me out of my medically induced coma, and they asked me who the president was and who I was and where I was and what year it was, and I told them all the right answers and probably said something funny. And I looked down, and my insides are open. And I was like, is this right? Is this, am I okay? Are y'all trying to kill me? But they had just had to make sure there was no internal bleeding. And so they sewed me back up, and they said, all right, you're going back out. So I said, okay. And they might not do this all the time. There might be some doctors in here or something, but that's what happened that day. So they said, all right, you're going to go back out. I said, all right, Roger, laters, you know. And they put me back out, and I flew to Germany. And while I was in Germany, I don't remember too much, and they called my family and told me what happened, and my mom didn't believe it was me. And she said there has to be a mistake. And they flew me to Bamsey, San Antonio. That's where I did a lot of my recovery. And at this point, I had stopped talking to God. I was very upset with him. And I was thinking maybe he doesn't exist. How could he let this happen to me? I'm a good person. You know, all these things people say when things go wrong, not having faith that he'll handle it. So I was like, me and God aren't speaking terms right now. So I'm going to listen to all the doctors and psychologists and the social workers, and they're going to be my God, and I'm going to listen to them and do what they say so I can live. And I noticed that they're humans. All these doctors and psychologists are all human too. So they started making mistakes. So I stopped putting my faith in them. I started putting my faith in myself. I started noticing I'm not doing things right. So I can't have faith in myself. So I'll trust in these drugs. So I was trusting the drugs that they were giving me. And the drugs were my God, and the drugs were my salvation. And these drugs that they gave me to cope with my pain and everything. I was taking all sorts of painkillers and all sorts of different things. And the drug of choice, I'd say, I had was Benadryl. Because when I was burned, it hurt my skin a lot. So the Benadryl made my skin feel cool, and I just really enjoyed the high that I had from the Benadryl. So I overdosed on that. One night, I think I took too much, and I caught a vision of hell. I don't know if I actually went there or it was just a vision or what it was, but it opened my eyes pretty much a lot. I remember waking up in my sleep, if that makes any sense, and I just looked at my arms and my legs, and they were looked like that puff of smoke right there. That's what my spirit looked like. And I started traveling down instead of up. I saw a pinhole of orange light, and I got closer and closer and closer. And next thing you know, I'm smack dab in the middle of hell. And When I'm in the middle of hell, the first things I felt was these three sensations. I felt hatred. The hatred there is like a tangible thing. It's like a fog. You could bottle hatred in hell if you wanted to and sell it. Like, it's, you know, everyone in hell hates you. All the demons hate you. And have y'all ever walked into a room and was like, man, these people really don't like me? Has anybody? Am I the only one? No? Okay. All right. I felt hatred. It was like a tangible thing. And next thing I felt was the heat. I know what being on fire on earth feels like, but in hell, the heat is much different. On earth, the fire, I always get this backwards. The fire feels the way it looks. There you go. Got it. You know how if you watch logs on a fireplace, and you know how the flames dance on the fireplace? You know, there's a little flame here, a little flame there. Well, on Earth, that's the way it hurts. It hurts like that. It's a little flame here, little flame here, little flame here. So, oh, hold on. My phone's not off, so I can't get mad at y'all for... I should not turn back on. The flames feel the way they look. And after a while, the flames stop hurting because it burns off all your nerves. So the flames actually, while I was underneath the fire, they got cool. But in hell, they don't. In hell, they feel like being dipped in acid for all of eternity. They feel like, if y'all don't know what acid feels like, if you ever stepped on an ant pile, little fire ants, like that, just all over your body. And so that was another thing I felt. And the other thing I felt was hopelessness. I knew that I deserved to be there. I knew that it was avoidable. I could have kept myself out of that. It, well, with Jesus' help. And I knew that it was never going to end. And so those are the three things. I felt the hatred, which the demons had for me, and the heat and the hopelessness. Those are the only things I felt that I remember. And when I fell into hell, I fell inside a house with no roof, and there was houses tumbling like tumbleweeds, you know, throughout hell. And there was all these little demons in the room, and there was a one demon. He was perched. He looked like a gargoyle, and in front of him, or the side of him, was a lady levitating on an altar, and she looked like she was 200 years old. She had white pieces of little blotches of hair. She was wearing black sackcloth for clothing, and she was just levitating. And that main gargoyle demon guy pulled me without even touching me, and I had my feet. I couldn't move. I don't remember moving, but I had my feet pushing down on the heels, and he just pulled me without even touching me. So then after he pulled me right to her, I woke up, and I just woke up crying, and I'm like, oh my gosh, I went to hell, and just couldn't believe it. And I talked to my doctors and psychologists and social workers and asked them what I felt. And they told me, it's just PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. Don't worry about it. It's not any big thing. It's not real. It didn't happen. And I believed them. So about a year and a half went by. And about a year and a half went by, and I just kept living the same way I was living. Saying I was the one in control of my future, and partying and drinking and taking medication, not overdosing as much, but I could have died that night. I don't know. It could have been a vision. I don't know. It just really indirectly changed my life because about a year and a half later, I had a routine surgery done, same day surgery. They were going to put this medical device underneath my skin, and when they put it underneath my skin, I started bleeding internally. And when I started bleeding internally, they said, well, let's just give him some blood. Let's give him 4 pints of blood. And well, they didn't say let's give him 4 pints, but they said let's give him a pint of blood until he stops bleeding. It ended up being 4. The last one I received 108 fever. As an adult, you can only get 105 fever and live to tell about it. Now, there's some cases out there, but on the usual, it's only 105, or you have brain damage. And as a child, you can, but you have 108, I guess. But I had 108, and I started crossing over to the other side. And I remember seeing all these doctors in the room, and remember them putting me on ice. My veins had collapsed, and they couldn't give me IV because I had a tainted vein, and they had gone as far as they could up my arm. I only have one arm, and they tried poking me in my feet and my neck and just everywhere, and they just couldn't find a vein. So, because I was dehydrating, and everyone in the room disappeared, and there was just these three entities in the room. This is pretty much what it looked like. There's these three entities in the room. One was a demon of lust. That was a problem in my life. She looked like that. She was really beautiful, but she had green skin, and she had a black halter top dress, and the halter top was real sticky, and I mean they didn't tell me they were the demon of lust, but I just spiritually discerned that's who she was. And there was another demon in there, and he looked like the Rock the thing. He looked like that, and well, he didn't have pants, but he was just a rock, and he was a demon of pride, spiritually discerned. He was a demon of pride. I had a lot of pride in my life. I was very, very prideful, and then there was this classic looking demon. It was like 2 feet, 3 feet tall, and he was just sitting on the edge of my bed, and I could show you what he looked like. He looked like this. He just yeah, looking at me. Yeah, I was just gonna prepare y'all for that. So, but he just looked back at me, and then he attacked me, and I couldn't move again. I just couldn't move, and they were just like taunting me and just harassing me and just making me feel like they were gonna take me with them tonight, that night. And at that time, they couldn't do anything. I wouldn't come out of my body. My spirit wouldn't come out. This angel came out of the ceiling like in a whirlwind. The ceiling changed. It morphed, and he looked like that. And that's the best picture. I'm an artist, and I should paint. I tried painting it one time and just didn't do any justice. So I just pictures off the internet, and he looked a lot like that. He was like 10 feet tall, and I don't really remember wings. I couldn't tell you if he had wings or not, but he had a silver armor with gold outlining, and he had muscles on top of muscles. I mean, he looked like Stone Cold Steve Austin with Fabio hair. I mean, he was just big dude. The really cool thing about it is, I know this is real, and this really happened, was his sword had these holes and designs inside it, just a lot like this star down here, this Christmas tree star. It had holes in there like that throughout the sword, and I don't know anything about swords, like guns, like machine guns and 2.03s and M16s, and I looked it up, and it's to make the sword lighter. And I know he's an angel, he's really strong, but this sword was pretty big. It was as big as he was. And so after he showed up, this everything just disappeared. I came back to Earth, I wasn't dying anymore. And my mom is a minister, and she was just praying at my bedside, and she just knew a spiritual warfare was going on. And so I was like, oh my gosh, Mom, oh my gosh, you've been right. You're right. There's definitely a hell. That thing I saw a year and a half ago is real. There's definitely demons. There's definitely angels. So there has to be a God, and I want to get to know him. There has to be a heaven. I want to go there. You know, so I started searching, and it took me a while. Like some people, when they find the Lord, it just like bam, just happens. But for me, it took a little bit, took a little while, and I'm changed man now, and I'm just working for Him now, and that's what we all are to do, is work for God. Like we go to work and we do our little hobbies, but really our life is for Him, like every moment, every breath, and every breath we're supposed to worship Him, and that's how we know if we're doing something right or doing something wrong, is does this glorify the Lord. So so I was on my journey, and I started searching through evidence, through I knew that if there's a God, and He had to have some signature, He had to have some design, He had to have some evidence for Him. There has to be evidence. So I did the like the movie, like God's Not Dead type thing, and did a lot of research. If y'all haven't seen it, it's a pretty good movie. I started doing the research, and I came to the conclusion that evolution is completely false. And then a little bit later, I met my wife. And this is Danielle. She usually starts the claps, we met, and she was a evolutionist, and she went to Stanford University, and she loved the Lord, but she just didn't know. I'll let her describe herself. She'll do it better. But all right.
So as Mario was saying, while all this was happening to him, I was in California just living the life of an academic carnivore. I just love the knowledge of the world. I studied anthropology, biology. Those were my two fortes, and I taught high school biology for 6 years. And I remember a lot of students questioning. They'd come together like in a little group and try to strong arm me and say, well, didn't men and dinosaurs exist together? And I was like, oh, no. They're separated by 65 million years, you know, according to the fossil record. And I just send them away, like, with their heads down. And now I look back, and I'm like, wow. How many kids did I, like, I'm getting emotional. How many kids did I steer away, you know? And so I was just all about what school had to offer. I wanted my A's, and I got to what I thought was the pinnacle of, you know, my educational experience. And then I met him, and you know, we'd argue, we just debate, and he won. He showed me things that I had never seen before. I had never learned about. There's just interesting things like the evidence for Noah's Ark and the flood. I was just looking at it through a different lens now, and we'll go into a little bit more about those, that information. So that's how I know got started. I'm about to show you a clip. We'll hold. Pause it. I probably need to turn up the volume a little. I'm about to show you a clip, and it kind of shows the attitude in academia when it comes to people that actually believe God created everything. So in this film, it's from Expelled. You'll see Dr. Richard Dawkins. He's a evolutionary biologist and a real militant atheist. He's on like a lot of the news channels as one of the talking heads. And we also have Ben Stein, who himself is an educated man, an economist, speechwriter, you know, really intelligent guy by the world standard. So if you please.
You have written that God is a psychotic delinquent invented by mad, deluded people.
No, I didn't say quite that. I said something rather better than that.
Oh, well, please tell us what you said. Please tell us what you said.
I would have to read it from the book.
No, please.
The God of the Old Testament is arguably the most unpleasant character in all fiction. Jealous and proud of it. A petty, unjust, unforgiving control freak. A vindictive, bloodthirsty ethnic cleanser. A misogynistic, homophobic, racist, infanticidal, genocidal, filicidal, pestilential, megalomaniacal, sadomasochistic, capriciously malevolent bully.
So that's what you think of God?
Yeah.
How about if people believed in a God of infinite lovingness and kindness and forgiveness and generosity, sort of like the modern day God? Why spoil it for them? Why not just let them have their fun and enjoy it?
I mean, I don't want to spoil anything for anybody. I write a book. People can read it if they want to. I believe that it is a liberating thing to free yourself from primitive superstition.
So religion is a primitive superstition?
Oh, I think it is, yes.
So you believe it's liberating to tell people that there is no God?
I think a lot of people, when they give up God, feel a great sense of release. And freedom.
Why do you think that? I mean, what's your dad?
I think, well, I've had a lot of letters saying that, and I've...
There are 8 billion people in the world,
yeah,
Dr.
Yeah,
Dawkins.
Know,
how many
yeah,
letters
yeah,
have you had?
No, that's quite true.
Professor Dawkins seemed so convinced that God doesn't exist that I wondered if he would be willing to put a number on it.
Well, it's hard to put a figure on it, but I mean, I put it as something like, you know, 99% against or something. something.
Well, how do you know it's 99%? I don't. Say not 97%.
No, I did. You asked me to put a figure on it, and I'm not comfortable putting a figure on it. I think it's. I just think it's very unlikely.
What? But you couldn't put a number on it.
No, of course not.
So it could be 49%.
Well, it would be. I mean, I think it's unlikely, but it's quite far from 50%.
How do you know?
I don't know. I mean, I put an argument in the book.
Well, then who did create the heavens and the earth?
Why do you use the word who? You see, you immediately beg the question by using the word who.
Well, then how did it get created?
Well, by a very slow process.
Well, how did it start?
Nobody knows how it started. We know the kind of event that it must have been. We know the sort of event that must have happened for the origin of life.
What was that?
It was the origin of the first self-replicating molecule.
Right, and how did that happen?
I told you, we don't know.
So you have no idea how it started?
No, nor has anybody.
Nor has anyone else. What do you think is the possibility that intelligent design might turn out to be the answer to some issues in genetics or in evolution?
It could come about in the following way. It could be that at some earlier time, somewhere in the universe, a civilization evolved by probably some kind of Darwinian means to a very, very high level of technology and designed a form of life that they seeded onto perhaps this planet. That is a possibility and an intriguing possibility. Mm. And I suppose it's possible that you might find evidence for that if you look at the details of biochemistry, molecular biology, you might find a signature of some sort of designer.
Wait a second. Richard Dawkins thought intelligent design might be a legitimate pursuit?
And that designer could well be a higher intelligence from elsewhere in the universe. Well, but that higher intelligence would itself have had to have come about by some explicable or ultimately explicable process. It couldn't have just jumped into existence spontaneously. That's the point.
So Professor Dawkins was not against intelligent design, just certain types of designers, such as God. So the Hebrew God, the God of the Old Testament, he doesn't exist in your view?
Certainly. I mean, that would be a very unpleasant prospect.
And Holy Trinity of the New Testament?
Nothing like that.
Do you believe in any of the Hindu gods? Like Vishnu?
How can you ask such a question?
You don't, right?
How could I? I mean, why would I, given that I don't believe in any others?
You don't believe in the Muslim God?
No. And why do you even need to ask?
Well, I just wanted to be sure. So you don't believe in any God anywhere?
Any God anywhere would be completely incompatible with anything that I've said.
I just wanted to make sure. You don't believe in any God anywhere?
No.
What if after you died, you ran into God? He said, what have you been doing, Richard? I mean, what have you been doing? I've been trying to be nice to you.
Yep.
I gave you a multi-million dollar paycheck over and over again with your book, and look what you did.
Bertrand Russell had that point put to him, and he said something like, sir, why did you take such pains to hide yourself?
Well, to some of us, God is not hidden. You know, we see him in creation. I mean, it's just amazing how so many different organisms are interdependent. They need each other, how all are the elements, our perfect position in the galaxy. We'll get into more of that. But it all seems planned. It seems very precise. And it's really interesting to me that this gentleman, Richard Dawkins, took a theory that a man made 200 years ago and is trying to apply that one theory that this one man made 200 years ago, who didn't even know what a cell looked like at its most complex form. They took that theory and they tried to extend it to the whole universe. So there's some being out there that had to be created by Darwinian means. Just doesn't make any sense to me. So we'll click. So in our media, in the schools, it may seem that science and God are at odds with each other. You just, what happened? Oh. And then just click so all the text comes through. These are just a few quotes from from different famous people and associations. So the top one from the National Association of Science, there's no debate anymore within the scientific community. For the most part, there is no debate. Creationists aren't allowed to be in the debate. But there are a number of creationists that are astrophysicists and geneticists. And a lot of them come from the Institute for Creation Research right here out of Dallas. I don't know if you've heard of them before, but there's a lot of intelligent people that still do believe in creation and have a lot of science to support it. Bill Nye the Science Guy, one of America's favorite TV personalities, he himself said that our Christian worldview will just not exist in a few centuries. He also went on record to say that if you teach your child creationism, that's a form of child abuse. So he actually said that, because we're stifling scientific investigation and inquisitiveness, when really the evolution theory stifles scientific investigation, because you're saying it all has to happen within this one theory, that there's a whole lot of evidence that would destroy this theory, and we'll get into that later. But so it's really interesting, some of the things that are said. And that very bottom comment, that was from Richard Dawkins. He'll show up a couple times in this presentation. But he says that it's absolutely safe to say that if you meet someone who claims not to believe in evolution, how many of y'all don't believe in evolution? Just, I know there might be some people on the fence, might need some more convincing. But he would say that we are people who are ignorant, stupid, or insane, or wicked. But he'd rather not consider that. Okay, next. And the truth is, well, a lot of the fathers of science, like Copernicus and Galileo and I can't think of any right now. Who, baby? Sorry, Isaac Newton. They all believed in the creator. And this gentleman, Dr. John Polkinghorne, former dean of Queen's College in Cambridge, UK, he said basically that in the very first picoseconds of the universe's creation, all the constants had to have been just precisely measured in order for the universe to form. He likened it to, like, for example, the expansion contraction forces that had to form the universe. They had to be so precise. It's like, if you just click through, it's like standing on one end of the universe, and we'll click. So you go ahead and stand over on the other end of the universe, click, click, click. And you got a target over there, and you shoot an arrow, and it's like hitting it bullseye. Like, that's how precise, and that's just one force. There's like 32 forces that all had to be the very precise measurement to even create a universe. Dr. Dawkins said in his book, The God Delusion, he even says that the universe had to develop so precisely, all the laws and constants had to be so precise, life wouldn't even be possible. We also have a famous geneticist, the man who led the human genome team to decipher the human genome. He himself says that DNA is a molecule that conveys basically the language of God. Like, he could see that in this very complex molecule. He himself is not a six-day creationist, but see, he's kind of like the way I was. I tried to marry evolution and my faith and say, you know, I tried to put my book learning into what the Bible said, and it just, you know, maybe he'll change his mind later. But basically, where you see design, like this stained glass window here, where you see design, man-made, obviously somebody had to measure that. They placed the different colors. They decided on the patterns. You know, you have that. And then you have something like on the right there, that's the DNA molecule. That's a picture of the DNA molecule looking at its axis. And you see from that there's a lot of, there's elegance in this design. There's symmetry in this design. And where there's a design and information, there's a mind behind that. You know, you don't look at a painting and think, oh, how nice, a bunch of colors just randomly splatted themselves on the wall. You know, there's a mind behind that. And you know, the DNA molecule itself, I mean, it's 3.1 billion bits of information. That's a 3D molecule computer code where you have in just one cell, well, actually, I think it's like all the DNA in all your cells could go from here to the sun like 600 times. That's how much DNA, and it has to be in the perfect sequence to make everything that codes from, you know, the shape of your toenail to the hair in your nose and the beating of your heart. I mean, all that is written in the DNA code. There's a mind behind that. And another interesting thing about DNA is that DNA does all really cool things, like it replicates, it corrects its own its mistakes and everything. But it needs like a cell to do that and the parts in the cell, but DNA codes for the cell and how it was should be built. And also there's a number of proteins that help build the DNA chain. So you got to ask yourself, which came first? If evolution were true, all these things happened in slow, gradual processes. So you have to ask, which came first, the DNA, the cell, or the proteins that were coded by the DNA? And the answer is neither. They were all created together, complete, by a creator. Click it. So scientists, both creation scientists and evolutionary scientists, we're all looking at the same evidence, the same information, but we just look at it from a different lens. And this is called our worldview, how we look at the world. And the worldview answers questions of origin. Where did we come from? Who are we? What gives life meaning? What's our destiny? What happens when we die? And what about morality? Where does that come from? Who decides what's right and wrong? The naturalistic, humanistic, Darwinian, evolution, nihilistic, atheistic, these are all philosophies that are born out of the evolution theory. They all say our origin is a primordial soup. 3.5 billion years ago, the earth started to cool. It rained on the rocks. In the soup that was falling on the rocks, a bunch of molecules came together and formed the first cell. And from that first cell, over 3.5 billion years ago, we get, you know, the plant life, the aquatic life, and then one of our ancestors walked out of the ocean and crawled up on two legs, and here we are. That's where we come from in the evolutionary sense. So that makes us animals. We're just higher animals. And what's the meaning of life? There is none. You're just here to enjoy yourself because you're going to die. And when you die, you're going to return to the dirt. There's no life after this. And your morality, you decide what's right and wrong. No one else has to tell you what's right and wrong. And that just makes me think of, like, you know, how does a society, like Hitler's society, how does that happen? People started to decide that, oh, it's right to kill Jews, and that happened, you know? So can we really trust ourselves to decide our own morality? I don't think so. The creation view is a very lovely one. I think I'm not biased at all, but I think that if we embrace this, we'd have a lot more, we'd probably have a lot less crime, a lot more people just loving each other. If we all believe that we did come from a loving creator made in his image, that we're here to love and to serve God and other people, that after this there is a judgment, there is an eternity, and also our morality is what's written in the book. God tells us what's right and wrong. And the Bible is, the first words in the Bible, you know, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. God knew we were going to wonder, you know, thousands of years after he set it all in motion, that we were going to wonder, where did we come from? And if we can't believe that first sentence in the Bible, why believe anything else in it? Why believe Jesus came and died for our sins and was resurrected on the third day if we can't believe that we were created by him? Jesus was there in the beginning. In John 1:1-3, it says that in the beginning was the Word, that's Jesus. The Word was with God and the Word was God. He was there in the beginning. Through him all things were made. Without him nothing was made that had been made. And in Genesis 1:26, God says, let us create man in our own image. So he's saying us, the Holy Spirit, Jesus, they were all there together. Hard to wrap our minds around that, but God is three-part, one being. And I love the scripture that Christ is the visible image of the invisible God. He existed before anything was created and is supreme over all creation. For through him, God created everything in heavenly realms and on earth, So even the spiritual things, not just the physical. There's another dimension here. Like my husband was talking about, there is a very real dimension. I mean, how else can you explain like miracles or these encounters that people have with the heavenly realms, both the positive and the negative? There's a dimension we can't see. Even physics will verify that they suspect that there's a number of dimensions out there. Okay, click. So the theme of creation is prevalent throughout the whole Bible. Also with the Bible, there's amazing things, amazing information that that God told us about before man science even discovered. So, for example, God said that the universe was expanding. We didn't figure that out till 1929 when Edwin Hubble figured that out. And before that, it was Albert Einstein had first found out that the universe had a beginning, that it had a beginning, and then they found out that it was expanding. Secondly, God's word says that the earth is round. There's a number of scriptures that talk about the world being circular. But it wasn't until after Columbus's expedition that they finally decided, okay, the earth's not flat. Also in Leviticus, God tells us to not eat fish without fins and scales. And he gave that law to the Israelites. And today we know that fish with scales and fish, they have a fish with skin, with scales and fins, they have a closed digestive system that allows them to excrete waste. If they were missing either the fins or the scales, they secrete waste through their skin. And this is why we don't eat those things like bottom feeders, or we're not supposed to eat them, even though they're so tasty. But they tend to be bottom feeders. But God knew that there's this thing called biomagnification, that when something on the bottom of the food chain eats like a toxin, and then the other thing eats that, and the other thing eats that, that the toxin increases in concentration as it goes down the food chain. So God was telling us in advance not to eat those bottom feeders. Also, it wasn't until 1845 when doctors actually started washing their hands in between childbirth and touching dead bodies, when Leviticus says that you're not supposed to do that. Dr. Semmelweis in Austria, if you read up about him, it's a really interesting story about what was happening there in Austria. Like, the women were dying at astronomical rates in other hospitals, but in his hospital, the women were surviving, and they're like, what's the difference? Well, we're washing our hands, and it's just amazing. The heavens proclaim God, proclaim his righteousness, and all the people see his glory. These are all pictures that were taken from the Hubble telescope. Like, this is our beautiful cosmos. We happen to be, well, most planetary scientists will say that in the center of our galaxy is a black hole. And in that area, there's stars exploding, there's meteors and comets. It's a very destructive place to live. We happen to live, if you click and click, we happen to live out here, and they'll tell you that this is the area of the galaxy where, like, not a lot of stuff's happening. But we're close enough to the center of the galaxy, because right here there's a lot of explosions, there's a lot of matter coming out, heavy metals, things that we need to support our planet. They're being spewed out, and we're actually at a point where we can receive some of that, but we're not so far out that we're not getting the heavy metals and matter needed to support our planet. So we're in this perfect position in all the galaxy. We also happen to be, Earth is perfectly positioned in just the right spot where it's not too hot and not too cold. They call it the Goldilocks spot next to our sun. And our sun also happens to be like the perfect size. If it were any bigger, it would burn us up. If it were any smaller, it wouldn't be hot enough to keep life going over here. We also have a perfect-sized moon that is just 1/4 of the size of the Earth. And the moon helps stabilize our perfect tilt of the planet. The planet is a 23-degree tilt, and the moon helps stabilize that. So as our planet is spinning out there in the galaxy, how fast is it spinning? Like 1,000 miles an hour? As it's spinning 1,000 miles an hour, the moon's keeping it suspended, and it does like this rotisserie chicken thing where it's completely warmed all over the place, and that's why we have like all this beautiful habitats to live in. If it were standing upright, the poles would be huge and we'd be mostly ice covering and we'd just have this little area around the equator to live in. But that's not true. We have all this beautiful habitat to live in, and this creation tells us that God is one beautiful because he created all this. He has a mind that appreciates beauty, and he's intelligent because he knows exactly all the balances of things that support it itself. So there's like 20 different factors that all had to happen at the same time at the formation of the earth in order for it to even support life. Okay, I only have 8 listed here. But we have to have the perfect position in the galaxy, the right distance from the sun being the right size and temperature, the perfect moon, even our crust, etc. There's more. But all these had to happen at the same time, same place. We'll click it. So what's the probability of that happening? Well, planetary scientists have done the math, and they say it's a 1/1000th and 1/1 trillionth of a chance of it just happening. Like if you just were to roll the dice and get a perfect planet with all the 20 factors, a 1/1000th and 1/1 trillionth of a chance. That's zero. Okay, if you put that into a calculator, it's zero. It's not even a statistically significant figure. They also did the math of like how much, what's the probability if you just roll the dice and got all the necessary proteins and arrangements to make the first cell? What's the probability of that happening? That's a 1 in 10 to the 40th power. That's a one chance in a number that has 40,000 zeros behind it. Okay, so that's zero. So the probability of having a planet just by chance form itself and a first cell form itself for no reason, zero. But you don't see that in the science textbooks. Wonder why. So all these numbers and don't really add up. I only did the planet and life. That is just even having a universe. That's just one constant of the 32 that needed to have a universe. It's a 1 in 10 to the 120th. So all the math just tells us basically that is a zero probability of this happening without God. Pause it. Oh, he said zero. I think he agreed. The volume's not. Okay, so we'll keep it paused for a second. So the math, if you like math, just to have the universe, a planet, a cell, zero chance. But let's just go even further and give us a little more ammunition. If evolutionists are right, this planet is 4.5 billion years old and humans have been on the planet for 100,000 years. Does that make sense population-wise, is the question.
Our present population is around 6.5 billion people.
More like
now,
7.1.
If we gave every single person on Earth 1 square meter, roughly a square yard, to stand in, it would take up a square area about the size of the state of Delaware.
Can you pause that?
According to current evolutionary...
So, did y'all catch that? Now there's like 7.1 billion people on the planet estimated. I don't know how accurate that is. But 7.1 billion people, I did some math myself. I learned that Texas has over 7.5 trillion square feet in the Texas landmass. So that means that the world's population can all live here in Texas with 1,100 square feet of space per person. So all this talk in biology classes, they say like, the Earth's overpopulated, we're destroying our planet, aren't humans so bad, look at what we're doing. I think that's anti-God, because God said that, you know, we're supposed to have dominion on this land, we're supposed to subdue it, we're supposed to be fruitful and multiply. God is a God of life, not of death, like the evolutionary theory says.
Thinking the first humans arose roughly 150,000 years ago. if we assume a very conservative population growth rate of 0.5% per year, within 150,000 years, starting with one couple, the population of Earth should be roughly 1.6 times 10 to the power of 325. That's 1.6 followed by 325 zeros. Notice this number is only for people. This ignores the alleged millions of years of hominid evolution before we even got to man. Even if we drastically reduce the population rate to a completely unrealistic figure of 0.1% and assume Homo sapiens first arose around 25,000 years ago, we should still have somewhere around 1.5 times 10 to the power of 11 people.
We'd have a lot more people on this planet if humanity has been around that long. So it seems that 4,500 years since the flood, with eight people starting it, seems a lot more accurate than, you know, this long, deep time. So this is an example of a clock. There's a lot of ways to measure the amount of time that the Earth probably is. And so human population is one of them. And then here's a couple others. Our historical records give us a date of, I guess, around 5,000 years ago. The oldest living organism on the planet is the bristlecone pine in California. The oldest standing one is like 4,800 years old. And that, you know, you tell that from the tree ring dating, being able to see how many wet and dry seasons were there. Dinosaur DNA that's currently being extracted from fossils is still intact. There is no way that soft tissue, DNA, anything that is apparently 65 million years old can actually still be intact. It would have disintegrated by now. And so they're thinking that even in a perfect condition, perfect freezing and sterile condition, the most it could last is probably 10,000 years. So, and we know that fossils, they don't stay in laboratory environments, you know, the whole time from when the organism dies to now. So it falls more aligned with our Christian worldview. The mitochondrial Eve. Has anybody heard of mitochondrial Eve? A couple science nerds in here. I love it. But they've looked at the DNA, the mitochondrial DNA inside the cells of, I think it's carried in, it's carried from the mother, but it's in men, I think, in their mitochondria. It's a structure in the cell. So they can look at the mutation rate and they can get a timetable about how long this person's history goes back to, their ancestors' history. And it dates somewhere between 6,500 years. And it comes down to one female. And it's interesting that when they had that date, they kind of don't talk about mitochondrial Eve anymore. And they, the first time it came out, it was fitting with evolutionary theory. It was 150,000 years was their what they came up with. And then they realized that they had been calculating it wrong, and then they got the answer of 6,500. Now you don't hear about mitochondrial Eve anymore, which is very interesting. Click, please. Okay, it's time for a stretch break. We have we have refreshments, drinks in the other room, so it'd be awesome if you could go maybe like 5 minutes, go and take a breather.